given the number of people here, you surely will not be shy about asking questions. And also, to make you even less shy about asking questions, I should say, I'm not, nothing here is new, and I'm not particularly an expert on this topic. It just seems like one of the most, you know, key problems in cosmology, and somebody should talk about it. Yeah, you should ask. And it's sort of a very basic thing. Yeah. Well, anyway. Basically the outline is first I'm just going to discuss, you know, what is the puzzle? What's the question we're trying to answer? And then sort of how people thought about this before Sakharov. And then what was Sakharov's proposed change of viewpoint on the problem? And then also, so Sakharov proposed a change of viewpoint. Initially, people were not, you know, didn't pay much attention to it for reasons that I'll discuss. And but then by the mid-70s, this began to seem, ever since the mid-70s, let's say, this began to seem like the more natural approach than the older one. And so I'll explain why that is. And then I'll just give a brief introduction to sort of classic, the first classic gut variogenesis. So the first idea, the first concrete realizations of Sakharov's approach were in the grand unified theories that came along in the mid-1970s. And so anyway, I'll explain the successes, you know, briefly the successes and challenges to this approach. And then an important development in the mid-1980s was the just realization that non-perturbative processes in the standard model led to baryon number and lepton number violation at sufficiently high temperatures in the early universe, and so that has ramifications for this. But then it also led to a sort of new paradigm, another sort of Sakharov approach, but different from classical gut baryogenesis, which goes under the name of leptogenesis. And I'll explain why, if you were a betting person, you might bet on this as being maybe the best bet for what caused the baryon asymmetry that we observe in the universe today. Although, you know, it's still open. It's still an open question. So that's the basic outline. And so that's point one. Sorry, I should have. I'll explain that right now. Yeah. Okay. So first of all, just without at the risk of being too basic, so the fermions in the standard model are divided into quarks and leptons. So the electron and neutrino are the leptons, and the muon and the mu neutrino and the tau neutrino, things like the electron and neutrino, those are the leptons. And then there are the quarks, the up and down quarks, and again, then those are the quarks of the first family, but then there's the charm and strange and top and bottom. Everyone knows this. So anyway, these guys have, in the standard model, there's a global conserved baryon number and lepton number two independent global U1 symmetries of the standard model, at least at the perturbative level. And the charges of these particles under that are that quarks have baryon number 1/3. So three quarks make a neutron or a proton or a hadron, and so a hadron like a neutron or a proton built of three quarks that has baryon number 1, and an antineutron, for example, an antiproton has baryon number -1 because it's made of three antiquarks, which have baryon number -1/3. And then the lepton numbers, so E minus and nu have lepton number, are defined to have lepton number +1. And then the antineutrinos and the positron and the mu plus and the tau plus, those all have lepton number -1. Okay, and so when I, so, the, where is an eraser? Oh yeah, thanks. And so the first thing to say, in this section, what is the puzzle, is that the universe today appears to be made of baryons, and there are essentially no antibaryons. Okay, and so what is the evidence for that? So the Earth is made of baryons, or we would explode. The solar system is made of baryons, or when we sent astronauts to the moon, they would explode, or when we sent satellites to Mars, they would explode. The sun is made of baryons because it's constantly bombarding us with a solar wind, and there would be much bigger fireworks if it was made of antibaryons instead of baryons. So that's the solar system. We're very confident about that. So as you look beyond the solar system, well, one thing we get directly from beyond the solar system are cosmic rays. So up to very high energies, we receive cosmic rays from that come from all over the galaxy, and then above a certain energy, the cosmic rays are even predominantly generated beyond the galaxy, we think. And those are essentially all baryons. They're all protons or maybe helium nuclei, you know, higher charged nuclei, for example, or there's essentially no evidence for antiprotons. And I should say that's actually a lie. You see antiprotons. The number of you do observe antiprotons in cosmic rays relative to protons at about a rate of 10^-4, but all the antiprotons that are observed are consistent with being secondaries from, say, a proton smacks into an electron and produces a proton-antiproton pair, and we see the antiproton from that or something like that. So you do see some antiprotons, but all at the level that's consistent with there being no primary antiprotons, those just being secondary products of cosmic ray collisions. Do people know what I mean by cosmic rays, by the way? That's another question I should have asked. So basically, we receive high-energy particles from the sky. Roughly speaking, you get they're absurdly high-energy particles, much higher than you can produce at the LHC, are raining down on the Earth from space all the time. When these are photons, they're typically called gamma rays. And roughly speaking, when they're anything else, they're called cosmic rays. And so a lot of what you get are nuclei, basically, that have been accelerated in some distant part of the galaxy or in some distant galaxy to some absurdly high energies, and then fired, there's relatively few of these out there, but nevertheless, when they hit the atmosphere, they make a big shower, and you can detect them. Okay, so those are what cosmic rays are. So my point is, cosmic rays are direct evidence coming to us from all over the galaxy and all over the universe that is all consistent with everything being baryons. And then another, if this is not convincing to you yet, another thing is that if there were, you know, regions in the universe, either at the present day or in the past, where you had sort of a region of baryons here and a region of anti-baryons here, then at the boundary there would be intense annihilation going on between the antiprotons and the protons, or you know, the baryons and the antibaryons. And so, you know, when a baryon and an antibaryon annihilate, they produce a photon that's at least the energy of the, they produce a gamma ray, a very high energy photon that's basically at least the mass of the proton in energy. So a GeV, at least. And so, you know, if this annihilation was taking place after, you know, after the CMB was already produced, so after the universe had become transparent, well, there's good constraints on how much gamma radiation is we're receiving at these GeV energies, and so it puts a constraint on this. We don't see any evidence for annihilation at domain boundaries like this. And even if it was taking place sort of before the universe became transparent, before the CMB was released, so that maybe you might say, well, maybe all of this annihilation somehow took place in the far past. And then instead of those gamma rays coming directly to us, they rattled around and lost energy against electrons in the early universe, and that's why we don't see them. Well, I don't deny, I'm not an expert on this, I don't deny that you might be able to play some games, and if you work hard enough, hide this. But there are you can measure any sort of injection of energy like this, injection of a lot of gamma rays in the early universe. You know, it takes a while for that energy to iron itself. That's very high energy radiation. It takes a while for it to iron itself out and thermalize with the rest of the cosmic microwave background. And the cosmic microwave background that we observe today has a Planck spectrum to some absurdly good accuracy. This was measured on the COBE. There was this so-called FIREAS instrument that was part of the first cosmic microwave background satellite, COBE, in 1992. And this thing measured with some incredibly tiny error bars the spectrum of the cosmic microwave background, and it's extremely close to, you know, it's extremely close to a black body. So by the time, by Z of 1,000, by redshift of 1,000, when this radiation was released to us, the fact that it had already become so perfectly a black body, you know, puts a strong constraint on any sort of annihilation between domains in the early history prior to that. So, you know, you can never... So my main point is that there's no reason to believe that there is antimatter left over in the universe in the late universe. All the evidence suggests that there is not. I don't claim that there's no way around it, but there's no motivation for it. That's all I'm trying to say. So there's good evidence that what we should be doing is not trying to explain how antibaryons are somehow hidden somewhere in the universe, but instead just trying to explain why the universe today is made of baryons, not of antibaryons. Okay, and so in particular, that's a qualitative way to state it, but there's a particular number that we want to explain, which is the number density of baryons today over the number density of photons. So this number is by now pretty well measured. It's something like 6 times 10 to the minus 10 at the present day. And this is plus or minus a few tenths, maybe. And this is measured in two different ways. So it's measured in the CMB. So you measure the CMB power spectrum. You've all seen this picture, I'm sure, of peaks in the CMB power spectrum. And as you add baryons, or subtract baryons, as you add or subtract from the number of baryons, you affect this power spectrum. And in particular, you change the relative heights of the first two peaks here. That's sort of the, qualitatively speaking, the part of the CMB spectrum that's really sensitive to the baryon number. And from fitting to the cosmic microwave background, we get a constraint like this. And then that's consistent with a constraint that we had, with an earlier constraint that had come from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So did Adrian talk at all about Big Bang nucleosynthesis? She did. So in, you know, in short, the idea of Big Bang nucleosynthesis is the universe was all protons, and then as it cooled, some of those protons were able to condense into helium nuclei. you know, 24% or something, and then a tinier fraction into some other light elements, lithium, beryllium, and you can imagine that, you know, what's going on there is that the competition between the expansion of the universe and the sort of temperature and density. So there's a brief period where the temperature and density is high enough for helium, for hydrogen to fuse into higher elements. And then that time passes. And if at a given density and temperature, if at a given density and expansion rate of the universe and density of the baryons, there's more photons per baryon. I don't know why I'm saying this in such a confusing way. It's intuitive that if you have more photons around per baryon, the photons, what they're doing is knocking apart nuclei. There's more photons around to come and scatter off of a helium nuclei or a deuterium nuclei and break it back into two protons. And so in the end, what you end up with is, if you make this ratio lower, you just end up with fewer light elements. More of the universe ends up in protons. And so anyway, you get a constraint from that also, and they both agree. So this is the number we want to explain. So in terms of explaining this number, I guess one thing. So the picture then is you might say, what if there were the same number of baryons and antibaryons in the early universe? And okay, so there were exactly for every baryon there was an antibaryon, and so as the universe cooled, every baryon found an antibaryon and annihilated to photons, and there would be nothing left. Well, that's not quite true. You know, there would be something left because the process would so-called freeze out. Because, okay, for a while, every baryon would be able to find an antibaryon to annihilate with, but eventually the baryons and the antibaryons would become so dilute, so diffuse, that an antibaryon simply was likely to just not find an antibaryon to annihilate with in the rest of the age of the universe. And so there would be some residual baryon and antibaryon density that those guys would just never be able to annihilate. They would sit around until the present day. So to make a long story short, that's true, but there's two problems with that. First of all, that would predict that there would be a residual baryon density and antibaryon density. It wouldn't predict why we see baryons today, but no antibaryons. But furthermore, it turns out to predict absurdly small values. So it predicts values that are, it predicts something like NB over N photon equals NB bar over N photon, something like, I think, 10 to the minus 19, whereas what you want is 10 to the minus 9. So it's much smaller than what you want. So this is not right. This is not how it happened. So instead, you're forced to the conclusion that what happened in the early universe is that when the universe was really hot, so during Big Bang nucleosynthesis, Adrian may have explained that when the universe was really hot, above a temp, we're here for these purposes, I mean that the temperature was greater than the mass of the electron, so something like greater than 0.5 MeV, then electrons and positrons, the temperature was high enough that it was freely producing electron-positron pairs. And so you had almost as many electrons and positrons as you had photons at that time. But then as the temperature dropped below this value, The thermal bath couldn't support these particles anymore. They all annihilated with one another, except that for every billion positrons, there was a billion and one electrons, which is why we have the small residual of electrons that we observe today. So this fact is true. This is basically, we have a lot of confidence in this because it's at temperatures that we think we understand well, and in particular, it happens at about the same time as Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which we predict and is in agreement with observations. And so So the idea is that what happened with baryons was the same thing, but at an earlier time, at an even higher temperature, you had quark antiquarks pairs that were being freely produced. The thermal bath was hot enough to produce quarks and antiquarks. So maybe this is a T higher than roughly speaking, GeV. But again, what we need is that when the temperature above this temperature, there were essentially the same number of quarks and antiquarks as there were photons, roughly speaking, because they were all just different relativistic particles. But when the temperature dropped below this scale, and these guys began to annihilate, that for every billion antiquarks, there was a billion and one quarks, and so we ended up with this residual of a billionth of them not being able to annihilate and sitting around at the present day. And so, so stated another way, this is what we're trying to explain. We're trying to explain why at early times, say at temperatures above about a GeV, at times prior to that, there was one extra quark for every billion antiquarks. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should you look at the dark ones, and then we have vertices. We have one say electron, one positron, and then a photon between them. But so the number of photons on these guys are not the same. But I'm just saying.
So in thermal equilibrium, so if you maybe sorry go.
No, you said that for relativistic particles.
So in thermal equilibrium, you don't have to, right? Because so the number density of species I, let's say, at temperature T, if it's really in thermal equilibrium, all you need to tell me is what is the mass of particle I, and is it a fermion or a boson? And then I know I just have to integrate either the Fermi-Dirac distribution function or the Bose-Einstein one. And then the answer that I get, so what you find, let's say you do that integral. It'll be embarrassing if I screw this up. But this is the energy of the particle. So p squared plus m squared over t, and then plus or minus 1, where plus is for a fermion, minus is for a boson. So anyway, you do this integral, what you find is that if the mass of the particle is equal to 0, so in other words, in the approximation that the mass is negligible relative to t, so you can neglect the mass. Which is what is the case at these very high temperatures, way above the quark masses. Then this integral only depends on the temperature, and it turns out to just be. So let me for the rest of the talk take units where h bar is equal to c is equal to k Boltzmann is equal to 1. Okay, so in those units, temperature. The units of temperature are the same as the units of mass, are the same as the units of energy, which are the units of length to the minus 1 and time to the minus 1. So number density is number, dimensionless number over length cubed. So that has energies, that has units of energy cubed. So on dimensional grounds, since after I rewrite E as p squared here, it was square root of p squared plus m squared, but now it's just square root of p squared because I'm neglecting the mass. So and then I'm going to integrate over that p. So the only dimensionful quantity that appears here, the only number that's not getting integrated over now is t. So just on dimensional grounds, I have to get something that's units energy to the cube. So it basically has to be something, some dimensionless number times t cubed. So and you do the integral, and it turns out to be some particular number that's order one, and it turns out to be one thing for bosons, and then 7/8 of that for fermions. But the point is, so there's a small difference between bosons and fermions, but this is what I mean in the sense that if you when you're out of equilibrium, you're absolutely right that when you're out of equilibrium, which we will be later on, and you want to calculate, you know, out of equilibrium, a certain number of particles decays to a certain number of other particles and how many get produced, then you actually have to go through and do the calculations. But the beauty of thermal equilibrium is that you can get a lot of information without knowing anything except the masses and the temperature. But thanks. I was definitely breezing through that too. These sort of things. If you spend too much time in an institute for astrophysics, you get comfortable with not doing things right. So it will be important to keep me honest. Where was I? I was going to say, I forget what I was about to say. Why are there a billion and one quarks for every billion anti-quarks in the early universe? Back in the 60s, the old picture was that, by the way, was Adrian's lecture, it's an hour or is it an hour and a half? Oh, I definitely won't take 2 hours. I'll even try to do it in 1 hour. But anyway, the old answer is that back in the 60s, everyone thought baryon number was strictly conserved. They had never observed any reaction that violated baryon number when counted in this way. When protons and neutrons have baryon number one, antiprotons have baryon number minus one, neutrinos and electrons and so forth have lepton number one. Every reaction that had ever been observed satisfied baryon number conservation, and most importantly, the proton was stable. People thought that this was the best evidence for the genuine correctness of baryon number conservation. Because I mean, why is it that a proton doesn't decay to E plus pi zero? This is a state that has a lot less mass and the same electric charge. You know, what's keeping this guy around for the entire age of the universe and preventing it from going through here? Presumably some other conserved quantity besides electric charge. And people had found an experiment that there was this conserved quantity, baryon number, apparently. And so that was the obvious explanation for what was keeping this guy stable, and it still is the explanation for what we think what keeps the proton stable. And so the fact that it had lasted through the whole age of the universe, they thought was evidence that this was basically an exact symmetry. And so, but if you think baryon number is an exact symmetry, and there is a net baryon number today, then that means baryon number must not have been zero in the early universe either. You know, it had to be conserved. So the idea was basically that as initial conditions for the universe, for some reason there were more baryons than antibaryons. Okay. And so if there was a puzzle to be explained, according to that interpretation, it wasn't why NB over N gamma was so small. It was the if there were people trying to explain this puzzle, they took the point of view that probably NB, possibly NB over N gamma, and a sort of natural expectation for what its initial condition would be if you were just going to set it as an initial conserved thing at the beginning of the universe is, okay, maybe it's roughly one. And then, so the question was, assuming that it was set of order one initially, why did N gamma get so much bigger as the universe went along? So in other words, this quantity, it turns out, is Or So I should have said. So the number that we measure is NB over N gamma. But this is a good proxy for an even better quantity to consider, a quantity that is more precisely conserved as the universe evolves, is NB over the entropy density. So for a gas of photons, its number density is just a dimensionless number like that you can calculate. It's like 4/3 times the zeta function at 3, but it doesn't matter. So it's some dimensionless number you can calculate from the Bose-Einstein distribution functions times t cubed. And its entropy density is just another order 1 number times t cubed. But more generally, if baryon number was really conserved as the universe evolved, and if entropy was also conserved, if there was no process that was generating entropy, if to a good approximation, the evolution of the universe was taking place adiabatically, so entropy was also conserved, then this is baryon number, a conserved quantity per volume. So as the universe expands, that would go as a to the minus 3, okay, a conserved quantity over volume. And then entropy density, if that's conserved because the evolution is adiabatic and you're not generating any entropy, that's another conserved quantity S over volume, so that also goes as a to the minus 3 as the universe expands, as the volume of the universe expands. And so this ratio NB over S you expect in such circumstances to be conserved. And so again, the top quantity goes as a to the minus 3 when baryon number is conserved, and the bottom quantity goes as a to the minus 3 when the evolution of the universe is adiabatic. And that usually is the case. Basically, roughly speaking, the condition for the evolution of the universe to be adiabatic is that the microphysical timescales for collisions between particles are short relative to the age of the universe. So basically the sort of collision time between particles is small relative to 1 over the Hubble constant. And, you know, usually these are microphysical timescales, and this is a cosmologically long timescale. And so for most of the history of the universe, and certainly for most of the late history of the universe, in any case, this condition is often satisfied. And this is a better quantity to think about typically. So if NB over S was of order 1 as an initial condition, the question, as people sort of viewed it maybe in the early 60s, the small number of people who viewed it at all, was, you know, what process came along and generated a lot of entropy in the early universe to dilute this factor from its initial value of order 1 to the value of 10 to the minus 9 that we observe today? You know, was there a strongly first-order phase transition, some very out-of-equilibrium phase transition where bubbles were produced and then collided in a violent event, or was there somehow a lot of friction in the early universe in some sense, or who knows what? That was the perspective back then. And then Sakharov comes along and says, maybe the story went a different way. So to explain his perspective, so Sakharov basically says perhaps what happened instead was that the baryon number was 0 initially because the universe was in equilibrium, and so the distribution functions for baryons were the same as the distribution functions for the corresponding antibaryons. And then let us ask, is it possible for the universe to evolve from that sort of state with baryon number equal to 0, perfect thermal equilibrium initially, to the state with baryon number not equal to 0 today? To state the problem a little bit more precisely, let me introduce the distribution function for the ith species. So there's various species, I, you know, quarks, leptons, electrons, every species. This runs over every species. And the definition of this distribution function is just that if I want to know in a little box and in a little volume in phase space of volume d cubed x, d cubed p, what's the expected number of particles in that volume? The distribution function tells me that. It's just the distribution function for that species times d cubed x, d cubed p. And then since we'll always be considering cosmology, which is, especially in the early universe, to a good approximation, homogeneous, statistically homogeneous and isotropic, we're interested in distribution functions that, you know, homogeneity means the distribution function doesn't depend on x, and isotropy means that it doesn't depend on the direction of p, only on its magnitude. So let's just specialize to distribution functions of this. No, I don't mean to assume flat space time. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. So d cubed, you might say that d cubed x d cubed p here is the wait a minute. This is I guess so if d cubed x is really the volume element minus the sort of three metric, minus the determinant of the three metric times the roughly, you know what I mean here, times the sort of co-moving coordinate times the coordinate volume. Then I think the conjugate momentum will have a 1 over root g, I think. Won't it? Who's with me? So will d cubed p d cubed x, will the spatial metric drop out? Anyway, you're right. You're right that you should make sure to have this. This is defined to be the number of particles per unit volume in whatever sense you make this. But you're right. You should define this in a way that's covariant under coordinate transformations. No. You don't have to assume you have flat space. Good point. I think the other way to say it is that you can for our purposes define this to be whatever you want. So in other words, you coordinatize for any coordinatization of, as long as these two guys are canonical, as long as these are really the momenta conjugate to x, then whatever coordinates you choose, this distribution function is just defined to be the number of particles per volume in that sense, whatever. If I decide after finishing this lecture and getting down from Blackboard that I'm saying something stupid here, I will email. Or do you see? Am I saying? Am I wrong? Does anyone disagree? I when I'm actually in the middle of talking, I can't judge whether I'm right or wrong. Yeah, certainly that's true. If you want, when you go between the, you know, coordinate and the physical volume element, and I think it drops out. But in any case, it won't be necessary for what I'm about to say. Yeah, so let me just continue, and then when I have a more coherent answer afterwards, I'll email. So all I wanted to say about this is so Sakharov's question is, can we have the situation where we start at at some initial time t star, with with distribution functions that are the same for every species and the corresponding antiparticle. So let me let F bar denote the distribution function of the corresponding antiparticle. And then from there in terms of these distribution functions, so the baryon number density, you know, you would calculate it by summing up the contribution from each species to the baryon density. And so this is the baryon density at position x and time t. So you would integrate over d cubed p times the baryon the distribution function of the ith species times the baryon number of the ith species, and then plus the distribution function of the corresponding antibaryon times its baryon number. But the baryon number of the antiparticle is just minus the baryon number of the particle. So this is just like this. So at this initial time, you know, if you plug this in there, that clearly implies that the initial baryon number is zero. And then the question is, at a later time, can we evolve into a state where the baryon number at some later time t final is not equal to zero? Well, that will clearly require from that formula that for at least some species, fi at p and t final is not equal to fi bar. And so the question is, under what circumstances can this happen? Or stated another way, what condition would forbid this from happening? What do we have to avoid if we want this to happen? And so in particular, the first thing to say, so by considering that question, he arrives at the three so-called Sakharov conditions. So first, the most obvious one is that to evolve from a state with baryon number equal to zero to a state with baryon number not equal to zero, you can't do that if baryon number is conserved. It would remain zero for all time. So condition one is that baryon number has to be violated. And then condition two, so if you consider the initial state specified by these distribution functions, then under a charge conjugation operation that swaps particles and antiparticles. So in other words, that sends your initial distribution functions to the conjugate ones. But since at the initial times we assumed, he's assuming that the distribution functions are equal to the conjugate ones, that means that under charge conjugation, the initial state is left invariant, right? The initial state is invariant under charge conjugation because these guys are just equal to the initial guys. Is that, whereas the final state, that's not going to be true anymore. You know, so now in the final state, charge conjugation sends these distribution functions to these distribution functions, but for at least some of the particles, these guys are not equal after I apply the charge conjugation operator. So in other words, if now this is potentially the most important simple but most important thing to understand. I mean, so, you know, I've just shown that since the initial state is invariant under charge conjugation, and the final state, to have baryon number not equal to zero, has to be not invariant under charge conjugation, that the theory that evolves you from an initially C invariant state to a subsequent C non-invariant state must violate C. Does that make sense? And then there's an exactly analogous argument for CP. Because I should write these as two separate things. Okay. So here are the distributions that specify the initial state at T star. So under CP, that sends these two initial distribution functions to, well, the first thing, C, again, flips the Fs to F bars and the F bars to Fs. And then P, well, P sends X to minus X and P to minus P. But since these distribution functions don't depend on X and only depend on the magnitude of P, that's nothing, that does nothing to them. So under CP, once again, we see that the initial state is invariant, since by assumption, this is equal to this, and this is equal to this. Whereas again, the final state, for the exact same reason, is not invariant. And so, we've shown that that in this picture, you need to evolve from a state that is C invariant and CP invariant to a state that is not C invariant and not CP invariant. So the theory that evolves them had better violate C and CP. And so you can see that. So why have we not considered various other symmetries? You know, there are all these discrete symmetries, C, P, and T. And why have we only considered these two combinations? Well, the first thing to say is if you tried P, it would cause no problem because it wouldn't reverse F and F bar. These states, by virtue of only depending on the magnitude of P and not on X, all the distribution functions are automatically, both at the beginning and the end, unchanged by just a pure P operation. So this argument gives no constraint. It doesn't require that the theory violate P. Does that make sense? No. That silence means no, right? That went too fast? More silence. I interpret that as a no. So
I didn't understand the question.
So I was just saying that if you went through, I just wanted to say that, you know, there are various possible combinations of these three discrete symmetries to try. Turns out, if you just check them all, try these operations for all of these different combinations, you only get a constraint from these two, C and CP, for the basic reason that C and CP are the ones that change F to F bar and F bar to F. If you try P, P by itself does nothing. It doesn't change F to F bar. It just sends P vector to minus P vector, but that doesn't change the magnitude of P, and so you get no. That's so that the initial state and the final state are invariant under P. You need the C, exactly right.
Then the T doesn't make sense because then it changes times.
Exactly. Basically, because the universe is expanding, exactly. Here, just to say that a little more explicitly, so since the universe is expanding, it's under the assumption that the universe is expanding, T is explicitly violated in these solutions. So you don't expect there to be any solution in either the initial state or the final state under T, because this is a cosmological background and expanding solution is, you know, clearly different than a contract than its time reverse, which is a contracting one. Okay. And then the final thing to say is that suppose you have some theory that violates C and CP. So you have some and Baryon number. It still won't generate a Baryon asymmetry unless you also violate thermal equilibrium. For the basic reason that we already saw, I shouldn't have erased it, but we already saw when we were talking about your original question that the distribution functions for a particle and an antiparticle at the same if the system is in thermal equilibrium, then the distribution function depends on the temperature and the mass of the state. But if the mass is the same for a particle and antiparticle, which it is required to be, it turns out, by CPT invariance, then in thermal equilibrium, those will have the same distribution functions, and you will never be able to violate Baryon number, right? Because for every species independently, as long as the particle and antiparticle have the same mass, these guys will always be equal, and you'll just never be able to generate a non-zero value for this difference. That part? Okay? Okay, yeah. Sorry, somehow there's a risk of spending way too much time on a completely elementary point, but also a risk of, like, missing the most. Well, anyway, okay, I hope that was clear and not too... So initially, as I said, people didn't pay too much attention to this because it appeared that Baryon number was a good symmetry. But then in the 70s, a bunch of things came along to change that idea. Okay, the first thing is that in 1976, Etuft pointed out that even if the standard model was correct, even if it was the full story, that although it appears vertex by vertex to conserve Baryon number and lepton number, that there are non-perturbative transitions between, basically tunneling between different gauge vacua, different configurations of gauge and Higgs field, that violate Baryon number and lepton number, both by 3. So a given, and so. So, and it turns out that those processes conserve B minus L. Those are still preserved by these non-perturbative processes found by Tuft, but B plus L is violated. And so, you basically have to give up at a fundamental level. That forced everybody to give up, without any need to speculate about physics beyond the standard model, the idea of Baryon or lepton number as both both good symmetries. But since this is a tunneling process, it turns out to be incredibly slow at low energies. So even though this process exists in the standard model, at low energies you don't expect it to cause any proton to decay because the lifetime it gives to the proton is incredibly long, much, much longer than the age of the universe. So, but nevertheless, as an academic point, it was important. Then maybe another point was that people began to take the view that the standard model was not the end, that it was some low energy effective field theory, some low energy approximant to higher, perhaps renormalizable theory, but that as a low energy effective field theory, you don't expect the renormalizable terms to be the only ones that are there. Instead, you're instructed to, beyond the renormalizable terms, write down higher order terms in the Lagrangian that are suppressed by whatever the high mass scale is that you integrated out. And you just write down any term you can that is built from the fields of the standard model and is a are singlets under all of the specified gauge symmetries, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And so, you know, if you do that, so the reason you usually say baryon number is conserved in the ordinary standard model is that up to dimension 4, you can't write down anything, any terms consistent with these symmetries. But at dimension 5, you can write down a term that has two Higgs fields and two lepton doublets. So that's suppressed. That's dimension 5 operator, so it's suppressed by one power of some high mass scale. And then at dimension 6, you can write down the first baryon number violating term, which has three quark fields and a lepton field. So anyway, at the level of effective field theory, you do expect there to be some violation of baryon and lepton number. You just expect them to be weak effects at low energies. More explicitly, in the mid-1970s, people came up with grand unification. And these models just explicitly had baryon and lepton violation built into them. So, for example, the simplest SU5 gut had particles, so-called leptoquark particles, which had two different decay channels. They could either decay into a quark-quark pair, or they could decay into an anti-quark anti-lepton pair. And, you know, so the key point here is that this guy has final baryon number 2/3 and lepton number 0, whereas this guy has final baryon number minus 1/3 and lepton number minus 1. And so, in other words, this X particle can mediate transitions between states like this and states of a different baryon and lepton number. Fourth, there was the discovery of black hole radiation, black hole evaporation by Hawking. And there the key point is just that whether I build a black hole out of neutrons or I build a black hole of the same mass out of pi zero particles, so this black hole, if I built it out of neutrons, I would put a huge baryon number into it. But if I built it out of pi zero, I would put no baryon number into it. But at the end of the day, I would have a black hole of the same mass, and if I arrange things properly, say the same spin, no charge. But, or in any case, the same charge. According to Hawking, these two black holes, at least to a very good approximation, decay in exactly the same way. So I put in two states with very different baryon number, but I got the same final state out. And so baryon number is hugely violated, apparently, by black hole evaporation. So those were all things in the 70s. More recently, as we'll see, the discovery of neutrino masses gives yet more reason to suspect that baryon number and lepton number are violated. But we will we'll get to that. So all of these things came along in the 70s and suddenly made Sakharov's picture seem not so bad, right? Because these things, C and CP violation, had already been observed even in the standard model before Sakharov's suggestion. And thermal equilibrium, it's not hard to violate that. I mean, especially since the universe, you know, by assumption was expanding rapidly. And so no matter what could at best be in quasi-equilibrium because, you know, an equilibrium state isn't changing in time. So just the fact that it was expanding and constantly changing its state and cooling is telling you that it's not somehow reached equilibrium at a constant temperature. So what I'm saying is that the one reason that people didn't take Sakharov seriously originally was baryon number violation, but then this list of things convinced theorists in the 70s that baryon number violation was really to be expected. And so suddenly, Sakharov's proposal became just as appealing as the old answer. And then the thing that really clinched the change, the sort of paradigm shift between the two, was the uh, was the suggestion of inflation. Inflation became popular in the early 80s, and you know, for this original answer is really in conflict with inflation, because you know, if you want to, inflation says that that whatever baryon number you specified initially was diluted. If baryon number really is conserved, then whatever initial baryon number you put in is diluted by a factor of a cubed, which is e to the 3 times the number of e folds of inflation, where n is supposed to be something like 60 or even bigger. So there's some enormous, enormous dilution of baryon number by some factor much, much bigger than a billion. And so to end up with, at the end of the day, with a baryon density to photon density of only one part in a billion, I mean, that seemed like a small number initially, but relative to the amount of dilution from inflation, that's an absurdly large number to expect. You would need the initial baryon density before inflation to have been very finely set to many, many decimal places to have it end up be basically almost one right at the end of inflation. In other words, inflation would have to end just at the right time. If it went a couple e folds too far or a couple e folds too short, you would get far more or far less baryon number than you needed. So with that said, I maybe just need 10 more minutes. Are people still, do people have 10 more minutes in them? Okay, so I was just going to say now, so fine, so now that people switched to Sakharov's paradigm, what were the sort of, what was the original, and then what is the newer, although still old at this point, sort of more concrete implementation of it? So suppose we have an X particle, and it has two decay channels. And let's just abstractly say the first decay channel decays to a state with baryon number B1 and lepton number L1, and the other one to baryon number B2 and lepton number L2. Then the antiparticle will also have two decay channels. It'll decay to the corresponding antiparticles, right? And so it'll decay to a state with baryon number minus B1 and minus L1, or to a state with baryon number minus B2 and minus L2. Let's say that the branching ratio, so the key point now is this, that CPT demands that the total decay rate for this guy into these channels is equal to the total decay rate of the antiparticle into these channels. The total lifetime for these two particles has to be the same. But if C and CP are both violated, then it can be true, and generically is true, that the branching ratio of this particle into this and this is not the same as the branching ratios of this particle into this or this. So, for example, even if the X particle mostly decays into this state and mostly not into this state, it could still be the case, if C and CP are both violated, that the antiparticle can mostly decay into this state and mostly not into this state. Okay, so let's call the branching ratio for the particle R and 1 minus R, and the branching ratio for the antiparticle R bar and 1 minus R bar. Then if we have an X particle and an X bar that both decay, so we just consider two particles, X and X bar, we let them both decay, and ask what is the expected value of baryon number in the final state. So what is the expected baryon number of that decay? It's B1 times R plus B2 times 1 minus R minus B1 R bar minus B2 1 minus R bar But that just simplifies to B1 minus B2 R minus R bar. And so, in other words, if prior to the decay, if prior to the decay, the number density of X particles and anti-X particles relative to the entropy density was this, then the baryon number, the ratio of the baryon number you guys probably can't see this. The ratio of the baryon number to the entropy density would just be the number densities, sum of the number densities of X and X prime times this factor that tells you how much baryon number do you get out for a given X, X prime pair. And then, finally, this factor here is really just, is again, in thermal equilibrium, is roughly, can be estimated as, so the number density of a relativistic species, again, is just T cubed, and so the total, and so is the entropy density. And so the total entropy density, not just of a single species, but all the species, is just T cubed times a factor, which is just how many species are there, how many different particles are there, how many different spin states do they have. So this is the so-called number of relativistic degrees of freedom times T cubed, and then just time, just with the numerator just being T cubed plus T cubed. So in other words, roughly speaking, this is just 2 over G star B1 minus B2 R minus R bar. So right now we're actually close. The question is, you want this number to be the observed value, 6 times 10 to the minus 10. And so the question is, can you come up with a high energy model, like maybe a gut, that has a particle decaying to two states of different baryon number, B1 and B2, like we saw that the leptoquark had that property. And given a theory, you can calculate the branching ratios, R and R bar, for those decays. And so the question is just whether you can get all of this, these three factors, to be equal to 6 times 10 to the minus 10. And really, that's probably no problem. So if for example, for that leptoquark, B1 minus B2 is just 1. Because it's 2/3 minus negative 1/3. 2 over G star. G star is like 100 or 1,000 for a gut model. And so as long as R minus R bar is 10 to the minus 6, roughly, then as long as you can choose coefficients in the gut to have these two decays differ by a part in a million, then you can reproduce the observed baryon number. And indeed, that is possible to do. But we're not quite there yet, because so far we've only discussed, we've invoked a process that violates baryon number and violates baryon number, which is why this factor is non-zero, violates C and CP, which is why this factor is non-zero, but we still have to make sure that the thing is out of thermal equilibrium when it decays, because if it's in thermal equilibrium, then even if the decay of X to stuff creates baryon number, the inverse process will be happening at the same rates. That all that stuff will be colliding together to produce X particles in precisely a detailed, balanced way to maintain equilibrium. I mean, the definition of thermal equilibrium would be if all such processes are going in the same rate in either direction. So even though a given process is producing baryon number, the inverse process is reducing the baryon number by exactly the same amount at the same rate. So to violate thermal equilibrium, the thing that we want is that by the time the X particle decays, Where's the best place to write this? So to violate thermal equilibrium, what we want is for the particle, the temperature, to be below the X particle mass at the moment that it decays. Okay? So I'll explain that more in a minute. So first let me say, what do I mean by the moment that it decays? Well, it decays when the age of the universe, which is h to the minus 1, is roughly equal to its lifetime, the lifetime of the particle, which is gamma to the minus 1. Gamma of x, the decay rate of gamma, the decay rate of x, I mean, to the minus 1. Okay, so let me just remove the minus 1s. So we want, so in other words, we have two conditions. This condition is just saying basically how old is the universe when the particle decays. And at that time, we want the particle to decay and not come back. And to achieve that, you ask that the particle's mass be big relative to the temperature at that time, because then all the relativistic species in the thermal bath are at too low energies. They're at a typical energy E. And so the probability for them, for those low energy particles colliding with such high energy as to produce a particle with mass that is above the temperature of the bath is very low. It's Boltzmann suppressed. I mean, this is the yes or no. Who's with me? Are you guys about to rebel about this point? Or do I belabor this point more, or did that make sense? That came out completely garbled, yet still it might have made sense, in which case I won't kill you with it by saying it again. If you have a particle that decays into a thermal bath that is at a much lower temperature than the mass of that particle, it's just like the same reason that electrons and positrons were being freely produced in the early universe, but then when the temperature dropped below the electron mass, all the electrons and positrons that could annihilated into photons. And then as the universe went on, those photons didn't. Those photons cooled. It got less and less probable, exponentially less probable, that as those photons cooled to lower and lower energies with the expansion of the universe, that they would, that you would have a collision event at sufficiently high energy, center of mass energy, to produce what had by that time become a particle whose mass is much bigger than the typical energy of the collision. I heard a lecture a few weeks ago by Mark Wise where he was saying that a standard teaching technique is to interpret silence as agreement and assent. This is my first experience with this. But if you believe me about this, and you should, the decay rate of the X particle, well, dimensionally speaking, if you have a massive particle and it's decaying into some massless stuff, the only dimensionful quantity around is mx to get the dimensions right. This has a decay rate is 1 over time. It has dimensions of mass. And so it's roughly going to be equal to the mass of the particle times some dimensionless factor, which will be like the gauge coupling squared, for example, if you're talking about the decay of the muon, and then some maybe pi's or something like that. But the bottom line is, so that basically it's mx, and then there's some dimensionful coupling that might be 1/100th or something like that. And then h we can estimate. So Friedman's equation is that the expansion rate squared is equal to 8 pi g over 3 times the energy density. Do you guys know this equation? G in units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1 is just 1 over m Planck squared. That's 1 over the Planck mass squared. That's basically the definition of the Planck mass. And rho, again, rho is rho for a species of relativistic particles with g star degrees of freedom at temperature T. So by relativistic, again, I mean you can neglect their masses. So the only dimensionful quantity around is the temperature to get the dimensions right. And energy density has units of energy to the fourth because it's energy divided by volume. Energy divided by length cubed is energy to the fourth. So this has to be g star T to the fourth, roughly. And that is roughly correct. So this whole thing is g star T to the fourth over m Planck squared. So I plug that in to the, I plug the square root of this expression in for H. And then I use this condition that T squared should be less than mx. Sorry, that T should be less than mx. So this should be less than g star to the 1/2 mx squared over m Planck. So comparing this expression to this expression, I infer the inequality mx is greater than alpha x over g star to the 1/2 times m Planck. So, in other words, the x particle, to get this scenario to work, everything was working great. We had this decay that a gut handed us a decay that satisfied baryon violation, so that B1 minus B2 was not equal to zero, and C and CP violation, so that R minus R bar could be of order 10 to the minus 6. But now we have a pretty stiff lower bound on what the X particle mass can be for the decay to happen out of equilibrium. But it's stiff, but not bad. So M Planck is 10 to the 19 GeV. This coefficient, say this is 1/100th for a typical gut decay. Like I was saying before, and G star maybe is 100 or 1,000, so square root of that is maybe 10 or 100. So this is something like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 of M Planck. That's kind of the natural thing that you would put in over here. And so that's not too bad. Mx has to be greater than 10 to the 15 GeV or 10 to the 16 GeV. Well, that's fine because guts, we think, are up at the scale of 10 to the 16 GeV. And so that's the expected mass for Mx. So that actually turns out to be another success. Everything seems to fit together nicely. The only problem is that I would say that is a good success. Guts seem to do a pretty good job. The only issue is that at the end of inflation, we now have an upper bound. This is kind of uneasy with inflation. Not directly in conflict with it, but we have an upper bound on the energy scale for inflation coming from the upper bound on the so-called tensor mode in the cosmic microwave background. So basically, from observing the polarization of the cosmic microwave background and seeing that a certain pattern that would be produced if that would be produced by very high scale inflation is not there, we know that the inflationary scale is not too high. We know the energy scale is less than roughly 10 to the 16 GeV, or a few times 10 to the 16 GeV. And then it turns out that the temperature, once inflation ends and the inflaton dumps its energy into radiation in the early universe, that the temperature of that radiation basically has to be lower. It's very hard to make it as high, and certainly essentially impossible to make the temperature higher than the energy scale of inflation itself. And so you have kind of the difficulty that although guts naturally produce particles of a sufficiently high mass to produce out of equilibrium decays, if you produce those particles in thermal equilibrium before inflation, the baryon number that they produce gets wiped out by inflation. But if you wait until after inflation, it's very hard to get the temperature high enough to produce such particles. Typically, the temperature at the start of the radiation domination era after inflation will simply be too low to produce MX particles, and so the mechanism won't function. Okay, so there are ways around this. People talk about one thing in particular is that people talk about preheating at the end of inflation, which is this. Anyway, without getting into the details, there are sort of non-thermal wacky effects that can happen at the end of inflation that produce spurts of particles far out of equilibrium, and maybe that's what produces these MX particles. So I'm not saying there's some strict problem, but nevertheless, there is a tension, I would say, between these constraints and inflation. Okay, and so, crap. Taking too long as usual. Okay, I will make this last part very short. So the other idea is, I mentioned that Etouft pointed out this non-perturbative process that is essentially a decay, is essentially a tunneling between two different inequivalent vacua of the standard model, degenerate but inequivalent vacua. And to tunnel beneath the barrier takes an incredibly long time, but the height of this barrier in terms of energy is something like the height of the Higgs potential. So as you get to temperatures that are comparable to and larger than the height of the Higgs potential, energy scales larger than the energy scale of the Higgs potential, then instead of quantum tunneling through, you can it becomes possible to thermally fluctuate over the barrier, and that process, it turns out, gets very efficient. So the rate begins to go, the rate for that non-perturbative process begins to go like temperature at temperatures above the electroweak temperature. So at temperatures above kind of hundreds of GeV. So that means two things. First of all, in ordinary gut baryogenesis, when you produce baryon number, it's not enough to produce baryon number and lepton number in the same amount, because if B minus L remains zero, then as you pass through a subsequent phase of where this process is efficient, it conserves B minus L, but it will thermal equilibrium will reduce B minus L to zero as you pass through. This process will wipe out any B minus L that was produced in the early universe. So you want to, I said that wrong. This process conserves B minus L, so it will not wipe out. It will not wipe out any B minus L. What I meant to say is, if you produce baryon number, but you produce an equal amount of lepton number, if you produce baryon number in a B minus L conserving way, which it turns out the simplest grand unified theories, SU5, do. So you might produce a lot of baryon number, but you produce the same number of leptons, so the B minus L is still equal to zero. Then this tunneling process, or not tunneling process, this non-perturbative process can wipe out all of that baryon number, and will, in thermal equilibrium, wipe out all of that baryon number without having to violate B minus L conservation. So there's two ways around that. One is that if you go to more complicated guts, like SO10, E6, these guys do not have to conserve B minus L like SU5 does. But another option is leptogenesis, where you make use of this, you take advantage of this fact that there are these transitions that change B and change L, but do not change B minus L. So the idea of leptogenesis, finally, where to go here? So the idea of leptogenesis is some process in the early universe creates a non-zero lepton number, okay, without producing. So you produce some initial lepton number without producing any baryon number. But then that means that your initial B minus L is just equal to minus L, because BI is zero. Your initial B plus L redo. 2-minute redo. Wipe out. I'm going to say this better. So you produce some initial lepton number. And now let us ask, after this non-perturbative process goes through a period of equilibrium, what comes out at the end? So instead of B and L, it's good to change basis to B minus L and B plus L, because one of those is totally conserved and one of them is totally not conserved by this process. So we want to ask, what are B plus L final and B minus L final at the end of the day? B plus L final, it's just being wiped out on a time scale gamma, exponentially wiped out, reduced to thermal equilibrium. So roughly speaking, it's whatever B minus L you produced initially in your leptogenesis process times E to the minus T gamma, where gamma, again, is the temperature. So it's being exponentially wiped out. So basically, it gets wiped out to zero. And then this guy is conserved. It's equal to B minus L. Sorry. B plus L is equal to B plus L initial, but then wiped out, because that's the totally non-conserved quantity. And so it's being equilibrated on a time scale of the decay time. This guy is just conserved, B minus L. And so that's equal to minus Li, because Bi was equal to zero. So now if I sum these two equations, I find that B final is equal to minus 1/2 whatever lepton number I generate initially. So the point of leptogenesis is that I produce purely a lepton asymmetry in the early universe. We'll get to how I do that in a second. And then I let this non-perturbative process convert that lepton asymmetry into half lepton asymmetry, half baryon asymmetry for free as I pass through the electroweak phase transition. Okay? And so why is that appealing? The basic reason that that's appealing is that it turns out that if the neutrino is Majorana, the basic reason that that's appealing is that I'm bad at organizing where I write on these boards. Yeah? Go ahead.
What is the meaning of the minus? Baryon finer and lepton future. The 1/2 in front of the 1/2, there is minus.
Right. So this is saying that let's also subtract these two equations. So L final is equal to L initial. So this is saying that is equal to 1/2 L initial. So this is saying if I produce some number of electrons in the early universe, that what do you mean by them? What do you mean by what is the meaning of the minus? Right. Does it seem like the charge turns out to be the wrong sign?
No, there's a sign between the F and the L, right? The minus sign.
Yeah, the F is the number and then the
minus.
Right. So let's say that Li is positive. That means that there are more electrons than positrons. And then that says that BF is negative. You're right. Did I do this wrong? Do I mean that B plus L is the thing that's conserved? Okay. I'm sure it's B minus L. So what am I doing wrong? Does anyone see what I'm doing wrong? Did you mean to say that so if L is positive, that means that there's more leptons than antileptons, and if B is positive, that means there's more baryons than antibaryons, And so the sign looks like it's backwards between the baryon asymmetry and the lepton asymmetry. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
I think that's true. What's going on? Okay, I know I'm just making a sign error somewhere because I mean, it is weird because I want both of these things to be positive, and they seem to come out with opposite signs. Okay, the meaning of the minus sign is that I'm screwing up the minus sign. Is that... No, I actually don't. I'm clearly making a sign error, and I don't.
So is it all the BRs or
not? So how would that? Wouldn't that have the same problem, wouldn't it? I think you want to conserve B plus L. If you want at the end of the day. No. What am I doing? Yeah, you want to conserve B minus L, because then if you produce a bunch of... No, you want to conserve B plus L. There will be another email about this. Sorry about that. Sorry. I am confused. Thing is, I know... My natural answer would be that it's B plus L that is conserved, but I know it's B minus L. So I must either... But I'm not lit. Okay, let me not waste your time by being confused. I'll be confused on my own and then send an email. Okay, maybe just the one last thing to say is that we observe neutrino mass is non-zero now. In 1998 thereabouts. It's non-zero but extremely tiny. Okay, so if you have a right-handed neutrino, you can write down some Yukawa coupling for that right-handed neutrino to left-handed neutrino. And you can write down some terms like this, basically, which after symmetry breaking correspond to Dirac masses for the neutrino, just like the Dirac masses of the other leptons, like the electrons and so forth. Except then you're left with the puzzle, which is if the mass term looks exactly like the mass terms for the other fermions in the standard model, why are the neutrino masses all more than a million times smaller than all of the other lepton masses in the standard model? So one of the most appealing explanations that has come along is that if the neutrino is Majorana, which essentially says that it is equal to its charge conjugate, then it's consistent with Lorentz invariance to write down another term, which is like which couples a new bar and a new bar. So this guy violates lepton number because the whole idea of lepton number is that previously every fermion had a mass term coupled with an independent conjugated fermion, so that if you applied a phase, it would cancel out the terms were such that the phase would cancel out between fermion and conjugate fermion. But here with a Majorana term, you have something like nu bar r nu left, but then nu left is nu bar r, so any phases you had previously assigned to that were an OK symmetry before you wrote down this term, no longer leave this term invariant. This term just picks up a phase. So this term violates Lepton number. You can show that you have decays like nu bar right goes to phi nu violate can violate C and CP in such a way, to make a long story short, to violate Lepton number. So it gives a when this paper was originally written, you know, the idea was, you know, here is a perfectly reasonable thing that we have no evidence for it, but violates Lepton number, and then the electroweak phase transition then converts that into baryon number for free. So the fact that then subsequently neutrino mass was observed at it turns out a level with a coefficient that is more or less consistent with the one that if you look at the original paper was they said, you know, in the original paper of Fukugita and Yanagita in 86, where they proposed this model, they worked out, you know, what is a typical value for this mass that would give for the neutrino masses that would give an appropriate Lepton number violation to produce the cosmological asymmetry, and they predicted something like so you know m comparable to or smaller than 0.1 eV gives about the right value. And so this is in other words, this is after the seesaw mechanism, the mass of the left-handed neutrino. So then the fact that people, you know, over a decade later observed roughly that mass is anyway some sort of indirect pat on the back to this approach. I promised myself I wasn't going to run over, and I've run over. I'm tempted to stop here. I think that's the, if I had to put my money on something, it would be leptogenesis. I'm sorry that the lecture degenerated in quality as it went along. It did speed up, so maybe you guys were bored out of your mind at the beginning. Anyway, I'll never know. I'll really never know. But anyway, thanks for listening. And unless there are any questions, that's it. Are there any questions? Do you? Okay. Take it. Well.